the FBI offered a deal to an undocumented immigrant, spy on other Muslims, and you can say in the U.S. The informant wants out, sets a meeting on a New York street corner, and brings along some legal muscle.
So I'm about to send this text message that says, I'm here with my attorneys on the northwest corner, just to let them know that he's not alone.
Also, it's been nearly 2 weeks since Hurricane Dorian decimated the Bahamas. The international rescue effort continues.
You know, it's hard. We're all human beings. You know, I'm a father. We all want to try to do as much as we can, and sometimes you feel like it's just not enough.
And Beatles fans?
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to...
The original Strawberry Fields is now open to the public. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Nearly 2 weeks after Hurricane Dorian ripped through the Bahamas, 1,300 people are still missing. Rescue teams are hard at work. Now there's a new storm brewing, and that's complicating their efforts as 15,000 residents remain without shelter. Daniel Gajewski is in Marsh Harbor, the biggest town in the Abaco Islands, an area of the Bahamas pummeled by the storm. Gajewski is a rescue squad officer dispatched from Fairfax County Fire and Rescue Department in Virginia. They're part of the U.S. Agency for International Development's response team.
I know with this storm coming up, we're starting to put plastic sheeting all over houses and get them prepped and ready. Since obviously having gone through such a significant storm and another one brewing, we're trying to take precautions and see if we can at least prep the community and get them ready for a possible another storm that could move through here. So that's currently what we're doing now. And then we've been working with the local government every day, a lot of reconnaissance of different areas, talking to the locals, trying to find out what their humanitarian needs are, while also trying to accomplish the rescue effort as well. We're moving through a lot of debris, trying to find any potential live victims.
Yeah, I mean, that must be a really grim job. I mean, what does that entail?
A lot of hard work, you know. We're out there every day, every morning, all day, just trying to move through different areas and just try to cover the most ground we can. If we come across any human remains, our job is to go ahead and to mark the area and to go ahead and push that information back to the local government, NEMA.
When you're going around the Abacos, I mean, what does it look like in some of the neighborhoods you were in today?
Depends on where you go. Some of the areas here in Marsh Harbor were completely flattened. All you see is a pile of sticks. Other areas, you know, homes are standing. The walls are still intact for the most part, with just some small roof damage.
You're meeting people, I imagine, who are looking for loved ones or friends and neighbors. I mean, what do you tell them?
You know, it's hard. We're all human beings. You know, I'm a father. A lot of the individuals on our teams are mothers and daughters and fathers and sons. So it's difficult. We all want to try to do as much as we can, and sometimes you feel like it's just not enough. But all we can do is go out there and try to give as much sympathy to them as we can, try to listen to what their needs and their concerns are, and, you know, try to go ahead and push their local government so that we can go ahead and get them the proper resources and help that they need.
No doubt one of the concerns, Daniel, is this new storm that's expected to come through the Bahamas. What is the forecast for how big and intense it's going to be?
I know that we're monitoring the storm currently. I know that it's slowly building, but I know that we're continuing to monitor it.
And any sense of when it's supposed to arrive?
Sometime tonight, from my understanding.
So the official statistics for the number of missing people has dropped by nearly half, from 2,500 to about 1,300. How reliable are those numbers, though?
I'd like to say it's pretty reliable. We have a lot of people on the ground. We currently have a team of 57 that we split up and put out there.
I'm guessing that if you were undocumented and living in the Bahamas, say you're from Haiti and without documents, you wouldn't necessarily want to step forward and say, here I am. And, you know, if you were swept away in the storm and undocumented, there might be no record that you'd be even living in the Bahamas. Who knows how many are really unaccounted for?
That's a good question. And the local government here has identified that as well. I don't have an answer for that. All we can do is, again, we put boots on the ground.
So what you've seen in the Bahamas over the last 9 days, is this the worst you've experienced on any of these missions you've taken?
I was in Puerto Rico. I went from Harvey to Irma, to Maria. I was in all three of them basically back to back to back. And I could say that this is every bit, if not worse, than with what we saw in Puerto Rico.
Daniel Gajewski in Marsh Harbor, that's the biggest town in the Abaco Islands in the Bahamas. He's a rescue squad officer dispatched from Virginia's Fairfax County Fire and Rescue Department. Daniel, thank you very much for speaking with us, and good luck in the days ahead.
Thank you, sir.
Here's something that many opposition activists in Russia heard this week. The sound of police. They conducted huge raids, often breaking down doors, targeting allies and supporters of the country's most prominent opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. Reporter Charles Maines joins us on the line from Moscow. So what's going on here? Why these raids, Charles?
Well, the Russian government says this has to do with a money laundering case that they've brought against Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation, which most Russians call by its acronym FBK. The timing of these raids that we're seeing, which are in theory linked to this investigation, is awfully suspicious, though. It comes just a week after Kremlin candidates suffered pretty heavy losses in local elections here in Moscow and some in other regional races because of a smart voting tactic pushed by Navalny.
Right. So just remind us briefly what that smart voting tactic was all about.
The idea was this: with opposition politicians really banned from the elections nearly en masse over questionable technicalities, Navalny called for smart voting, a strategy that corralled votes behind whatever candidate, didn't matter the persuasion, it could be a communist, it could be a nationalist, whatever candidate was most likely to beat Kremlin-backed opponents affiliated with the United Russia Party, so affiliated with Vladimir Putin. And this, according to Navalny, caused Vladimir Putin to, quote, get angry and stamp his little feet.
Vladimir Putin очень расстроился и стучит ножками.
So Navalny's saying here that this time Putin got really upset because the smart vote defeated what he called Putin's favorite offspring, the United Russia Party, and that the United Russia Party had been defeated not only in Moscow, but beaten in the regions. And this is what caused him to, quote, stomp his little feet. So, for example, in Novosibirsk, a guy named Sergei Boyko, he's the head of Navalny's operations out there, and he posted this video where police are taking an axe to his door. That actually took some time for them to knock down the door, so he used the opportunity to calmly use a drone to ferry out critical hard drives and SD cards.
Это дрон с жесткими дисками.
And he posted this all, of course, on YouTube.
Самое главное в российской политике.
In this video, he says the most important thing in Russian politics is a well-made door, obviously keeping a sense of humor under unpleasant circumstances.
Yeah, I'll say. Charles, people involved with the opposition and with Navalny, they get targeted all the time. Was this operation any different?
Well, it's true they get targeted. We just had a summer where opposition politicians spent most of it, frankly, in jail. But what's different about this was the scope. In fact, I reached out to Navalny's chief strategist, Leonid Volkov, reached him in London, actually, and asked him if he was surprised by these raids.
We expected something like this to happen. The only thing that happened unexpected that it was so very well orchestrated and so very well, like, synchronized. It was designed in a very smart way to cause maximal possible damage.
Maximum damage because these raids were conducted in 41 cities in hundreds of locations. We had police raiding not only the Navalny-affiliated offices, but also the homes of the headquarters and their relatives as well.
So a few months ago, Charles, you and I were in the city of Nizhny Novgorod,
right,
a few hours from Moscow, reporting on Navalny and the opposition's work there. Have you spoken with any of the people we met there? Were they also targeted?
Right. You know, you'll remember our host at Navalny's headquarters in Nizhny Novgorod was a guy named Dmitry Silivonchik. I reached out to him when I heard about these raids, and he said that police had first come to his mother's place, then made their way to his apartment. Of course, they were also at the headquarters where you and I were. And they proceeded basically to turn that place upside down. So Dmitry here is saying that there were two goals in his mind. It was, first of all, an act intended to scare everybody, but it also to paralyze the work of the organization. He points out that they took all the equipment. For example, they took Dmitry's phone, his computer. And he just said, you know, look, this is not pleasant, but it was definitely intended to intimidate and also create problems for everyone there financially.
So what do you think all of this tells us about how the Russian government is taking in the election results from last weekend? I mean, Moscow is kind of a humiliation for Putin.
Well, if you believe Leonid Volkov, he says that the Kremlin has studied the math of the Moscow vote and they don't like what they see. You know, smart voting was a trial balloon here. It was really heavily debated. A lot of people didn't like the idea of voting for candidates that they don't actually approve of. But ultimately, it proved pretty effective in terms of the actual results. So Volkov's point is that if you expand the effort into the regions, if you expand the number of people who actually participate in the strategy, the numbers kind of work their own magic. And that's really important when you look at upcoming elections in 2020, another more regional elections, and then the big Duma elections, that's for the parliament here, in 2021. So that raises the prospect, anyway, of basically pro-Kremlin candidates being beaten across the country.
The opposition in Russia look into the future. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks as always.
Thank you.
If you join us here often, you might be accustomed to a regular dose of Brexit coverage. So for you lovers of all things Brexit, don't worry, we got your back. Yesterday, we told you about the news of the Yellowhammer Report, a government study that outlines some pretty bleak scenarios if the UK leaves the European Union without a deal. Things like riots, spikes on food prices, and shortages of medicine. It's been all the talk in the UK, especially on talk radio.
David in Birmingham, you're through to Jacob Rees-Mogg. David, your call. Good morning.
Good morning, Jacob.
Good morning, David.
Jacob Rees-Mogg, senior member in Prime Minister Boris Johnson's cabinet, and David in Birmingham, that's David Nicol, a neurologist who helped draft the Yellowhammer Report, calling into London radio station LBC.
My question to you, really, having been involved in writing plans of mitigation, having whistleblown because I felt they were unsafe, is what level of mortality rate are you willing to accept in the light of a no-deal Brexit?
Well, I don't think that there's any reason to suppose that a no-deal Brexit should lead to a mortality rate. I think this is the worst excess of Project FEAR, and I'm surprised that a doctor in your position would be fear-mongering in this way on public radio.
And from British radio to our own now, we've got Dr. David Nicol on the line with us. Dr. Nicol, you are being accused of fear-mongering, and not just by Jacob Rees-Mogg. How do you respond?
Well, that was last week. A lot of water has gone under the bridge since then. He slandered me in the House of Commons, and then I went down to London and stood outside the House of Commons with a very large megaphone, shouted at the House of Commons and said, repeat that outside and I'll sue you. And he then apologized.
So remind us what your role was exactly in writing the Yellowhammer Report.
Well, I don't want to over-egg this because I feel like a very small cog in a very large piece of work. I'm a consultant neurologist. And going back to January, the Royal College of Physicians, which is not a campaigning group, it's a charity, was approached by the Department of Health to advise plans of mitigation for no-deal Brexit. And I volunteered because, in a sense, somebody had to do it.
I mean, since you started consulting, what's changed for you about your concerns of a no-deal Brexit since then?
I would say nothing's changed. In fact, if anything, my anxiety has gone up. Because I've become better informed about other areas, nothing to do with neurology. One particular issue is of concern is that for technical reasons, the type of flu that we're expecting this year, it's taken longer to produce the flu vaccine. And Sanofi, one of the manufacturers of the flu vaccine, reported on Newsnight last month that there are problems with stockpiling flu vaccine this year. Now, if we get hit with a big flu outbreak this autumn and we've crashed out no-deal Brexit, there is a really very serious risk. And that's just flu vaccine, okay? Mm. We haven't even talked about all the other drugs.
There's also a terrible...
I'm sorry to be so emphatic about this, but I'm fed up with people trying to spin this when I helped write the documents. Same question that I challenged Jacob Rees-Mogg is still true today, which is what level of harm are you willing to accept in the event of a no-deal Brexit?
In other words, you're asking politicians how many people are you willing to let die before you kind of...
Frankly, yes, they do need to be asked that. It's pretty tense, this, but I keep going back to saying it's a government report, okay? You may disagree with that government report, but you may disagree with those expert advisors, but you know, you're the one, you know, if you've asked an expert advice or to give a candid opinion and you don't like the advice, okay, you need to be prepared to take those consequences, which goes back to my question. What level of harm are you willing to accept?
David Nicol is a neurologist in the UK. He advised the UK government on the recent Yellowhammer report that outlines the worst possible scenarios of a no-deal Brexit, medically speaking. Dr. Nicol, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, an undocumented immigrant strikes a deal with the FBI to spy on his fellow Muslims, then wants out. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Imagine you're an undocumented immigrant and you're Muslim, and the FBI offers you a deal. You can remain in the country, but only if you'll spy for them. Do you take the deal? WNYC's Arun Venugopal has a story of one man who faced that choice.
There are certain things we can't tell you about the subject of this story, like his real name. So we'll just call him Bilal. Bilal is from Uzbekistan. He's in his 30s and came to this country in 2012 and overstayed his tourist visa. he first started working at a Russian newspaper, then at a barbecue joint in Brooklyn. One night, at around 3 o'clock, there was a knock on the door.
Polizia geldi, immigration, FBI geldi. Üçtesi ambulance too.
He said immigration, ICE officers were at the door, FBI and police too. About 25 people in all. They asked for his passport and handcuffed him. He was taken in and questioned by 5 FBI agents. Bilal said they asked him all sorts of questions about his faith. Was he Sunni or Shia? Did he approve of certain acts of extremism? They showed him pictures of people and asked if he knew them. And then... He said they asked him to spy for them, to help catch criminals. Bilal said he didn't want to spy, but reluctantly he agreed to become an FBI informant. In return, he got papers to live in the U.S. He showed me a letter he got from ICE. It said he could remain here until the government determined, quote, the need for this type of action is no longer warranted. He'd also need to report to a case agent or officer. And so he did. But he was ambivalent at first. He said agents would show him pictures, including of people Bilal knew, people he said were not terrorists. This was in 2017, around the time a man drove a truck down a bike path in New York City and killed 8 people. The suspect in that case was also from Uzbekistan, like Bilal. So he was sent on an endless fishing expedition, randomly chatting up members of the Uzbek community at mosques, asking for their stance on hot-button political issues like, say, Syria, and reporting back to his FBI handlers. This arrangement has been common for Muslims since 9/11. Faiza Patel is a national security expert at New York University. She said this type of phishing is problematic.
And that creates a lot of distrust, particularly Muslim communities, because people are always looking at the guy next to them and saying, oh, is he an informant?
As time wore on, Bilal became more reluctant about working for the FBI. Occasionally, he said, his handlers didn't think he was doing his best. A few months ago, Bilal sought a way out of this arrangement and connected with a lawyer, Ramzi Qasim. He's a professor at the City University of New York who directs a project there called CLEAR, short for Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility. Qasim says that when they first met, Bilal was going through a spiritual crisis.
It used to feel good to go to the mosque, to be with his community, to worship together. And doing what he's been doing for the FBI has turned what used to be a very positive and affirming feeling for him, something that was really central to his spiritual and social life, into something that he'd rather avoid doing, and that he did with a heavy conscience.
The CLEAR team had represented others who wanted to break away from informant deals. But in Bilal's situation, they tried something they hadn't before. Qasim said normally the FBI relies on 2 elements in dealing with informants, secrecy and fear.
And so we started to think that the antidotes, naturally, and that our strategy to counter secrecy and fear should be sunlight, public scrutiny, and community organizing.
And so they prepared for Bilal's next check-in with the FBI. He was told to meet on a street in Manhattan. Normally, he'd show up alone, but this time, he was accompanied by his legal team, as well as several sympathetic members of the activist community, and me. Before the agents showed up, the attorney, Ramzi Qasim, held Bilal's phone in his hands and drafted a text on his behalf as I watched.
All right, so I'm about to send this text message that says, I'm here with my attorneys on the northwest corner just to let them know that he's not alone.
And why?
Because we're dealing with armed FBI agents and we don't want there to be any surprises.
Bilal is quietly taking it all in. He's decided to break up with the FBI right here in plain sight in the middle of Manhattan. And I ask him through an Uzbek interpreter what he thinks of his FBI contacts. He says he feels bad when he talks to them, because whenever they can, they take his words and twist them, attribute a different meaning than the one he intended. Before long, a vehicle with dark tinted windows drives by. This gets Bilal's attention. But the car doesn't stop.
Oh,
Hello?
Hello?
A few minutes later, though, the FBI and Bilal's team are on the phone with one another.
Well, he has retained us as his counsel, and our understanding is that you are with the FBI and you're interested in working with him. Is that correct?
The woman on the other end doesn't confirm or deny that she's with the FBI. She simply says Bilal has voluntarily been providing information.
Okay, well, let me just make some things clear. Mr. is not going to be working with you all anymore. And if you have any questions or concerns about that, please contact us. We were willing
Bilal
to
says he feels
today.
A little better. As for where things will go from here, he says that's in God's hands. We reached out to the FBI and ICE to learn how these arrangements work with informants like Bilal, but we never heard back. A few days later, Bilal was contacted again by the FBI. This time, the agents wanted to meet him at their office in Manhattan. It's also where immigration agents work. Qasem, the attorney, wasn't worried.
Really, what they're doing there is they're just rolling the dice. They're just seeing if he'll go along with it.
Bilal and his attorneys skipped the appointment. In the weeks since, they haven't heard anything else. Still, it seems unlikely that the FBI is going to disappear. And that worries Bilal, that he'll be deported or outed as someone who spied for the FBI. But this isn't only about one man. Bilal has been approaching the various communities upon which he spied and confessing to his deception.
It was pretty shocking. When
Imam Hassan Raza leads the Al-Ansar Center in Brooklyn. He'd gotten to know Bilal over time and thought he was just another worshiper. But this wasn't the first time the mosque had been spied upon. The NYPD did the same thing too. The revelations had a profound impact on the congregation. By the imam's estimate, attendance at the mosque fell sharply.
I mean, no one likes to be watched, especially when there's nothing wrong. We are not doing anything wrong. We are doing just about everything that everyone, all other Americans are doing, and we are.
But the imam has accepted Bilal's confession and apology. And since then, Bilal has returned to the mosque several times. No longer a spy, merely a man of faith. For the World, Arun Venugopal, New York.
A gunman in New Zealand massacred 51 people last March. The government there sprang to action, banning military-style assault weapons. Many hunters there support that.
Most of my friends who are hunters tend to have a dismal view of people who require more than one shot to kill an animal. And so they're quite supportive of getting these other firearms off the street.
Coming up, how New Zealand is dealing with guns. You're with the World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. 6 months ago, New Zealand was stunned by the worst massacre in that nation's modern history. A lone gunman, a white supremacist, opened fire at two mosques in the city of Christchurch. 51 people were killed. The government acted quickly. New Zealand implemented new laws banning military-style semi-automatic weapons. They're also 6 weeks into a mandatory gun buyback program. And today, New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, announced new funding for mental health services.
This funding will go into supporting treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder and other serious issues, community mental health and addiction support, cultural competency training for GPs, allowing extended GP consultations for those directly affected by the attacks, and also initiatives that help build community resilience.
Gun reform advocates here in the U.S. have been watching these reforms closely. Alexander Gillespie teaches law at the University of Waikato in New Zealand.
The idea is that the government created a list of prohibited military-style firearms. The government then offers a fair market rate for the buyback of the firearms. In the past, we've had firearms amnesties, but we've never put money on the table. So the idea now is that since firearm owners are losing something which they lawfully possessed, that it's only correct that they get a good amount of compensation. So far, about 20,000 have been handed in and destroyed.
So 20,000. Do you know how many guns might still be out there?
There's debate because although New Zealand has a record of which firearms have been imported since 1983, there's a gap for before 1983. We don't have a firearms register except for the most military-style firearms. So the police are working on a broad estimate of about 240,000 but there's a lot of discrepancy and debate around the exact number. Because we don't have strong figures, we'll never know whether we have a good degree of compliance or not.
So this kind of buyback program is hugely controversial in the US. Has the program there in New Zealand gotten resistance from gun owners?
Yes, there has been some resistance, but there's also been some support. You'll have to deal with not only the legal firearms owners, but also the illegal firearms owners like the gangs. And some gang members have said there's no way on earth that they're going to hand over what they already possess. The public mood, however, has been that it is necessary, and there's been strong cross-party support throughout our parliament for this action. The greater difficulty will be with the second tranche of gun law reform, which will come up in a couple of months. The government is aiming for a registry of all firearms. So that means that the police will know at all times all of the firearms which are in the community.
Are there any privacy concerns about this gun registry?
There was near universal agreement for the buyback scheme. But once we have the registry, the two main political parties are splitting right down the middle. The concern is partly about privacy and partly around it not being necessary. You must remember, we don't have a right to own firearms. We have a privilege to own firearms.
Alexander, I'm curious, do you know anybody who owns a gun and who has handed it in? Have they told you why they feel it's important?
Most of my friends who are gun owners are hunters, and so they're not the type of people who desire military-style firearms. Most of my friends who are hunters tend to have a dismal view of people who require more than one shot to kill an animal. And so they're quite supportive of getting these other firearms off the street because they don't see them as having any legitimate purpose in the hunting community. You may get a few outliers, but I don't think that will be anywhere near a significant amount.
I see there's a time limit on this buyback program, December 20th. Why limit it?
Well, the idea is otherwise it could go on in perpetuity. What we've learned from overseas practice, such as in Australia, is that there's a surge at the beginning, there's a lull in the middle, and then there's another surge at the end. But even in a best case scenario, you'll never get 100% of the firearms that are now prohibited out of the community. It takes a long period for that to happen, but the prohibited firearms are no longer coming into the country either. There's strong support for our Prime Minister in the way she's handled this, but the issue has not just been about gun control. It's been about trying to control hatred online, and so there's been a package of response to what happened in Christchurch. At the moment, compared to other countries, we seem to be making progress.
Alexander Gillespie, a professor at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Flavored e-cigarettes may be getting their last drag in the U.S.
We have a problem in our country. It's a new problem. It's a problem that nobody really thought about too much a few years ago, and it's called vaping.
President Trump announced a plan this week to ban them with strong backing from Health and Human Services leader Alex Azar.
Currently, about 8 million adults use e-cigarettes, but 5 million children are using e-cigarettes.
In the U.S., at least 6 deaths have been blamed on e-cigarette use, and more than 400 people have contracted pneumonia from vaping. In the U.K., it's a different story.
We're seeing experimentation, but we're not seeing regular use, except amongst young teenagers who are already smoking.
Deborah Arnott directs the nonprofit Action on Smoking and Health, or ASH, in the UK. It's a nonprofit advocacy group that's heavily involved in tobacco policy.
And I think one of the differences is there's a sort of moral panic going on in America, which, to be honest, I think actually encourages young people to take up vaping, whereas here it's being promoted only as something for adult smokers to do to quit. So our public health agency, rather than producing worrying and alarmist pictures of young people vaping, if it shows vaping, it's sort of middle-aged men with grey hair vaping to switch from smoking. So it doesn't come across as cool.
And why do you think that is, that it's not cool among kids? Because my kid comes home from school, high school, and, you know, she's talking about kids vaping in the bathroom. And if you're not doing it, you're not cool.
Vaping has been seen by our medicines authority, by our Ministry of Health, by our public health agencies, and by medical organizations like our Royal College of Physicians and the British Medical Association, as well as advocacy organizations like ASH, as something really which is there for adult smokers. It's not been glamorized. It's not been hyped. And for the last 3 years, we've had strict controls on advertising.
So what does advertising look like for e-cigarettes in the UK?
Our Advertising Standards Authority regulates what there is, and what there is basically only on billboards or bus shelters or buses or at point of sale. And it can't show anyone vaping who looks under 25. You know, I'm not saying it's perfect, but when I look at, for example, how blu is advertised here compared to how it's advertised in America or how it was advertised before the advertising restrictions came in here, it's the other side of the world.
So Juul entered the U.S. market in 2015. This past week, the FDA issued a warning to the company. It's the biggest maker of e-cigarettes here for mismarketing the devices to young adults, especially through social media. Last year, Juul entered the UK market. What's been the impact?
There is awareness of Juul and some usage, but it's not taking off quite as rapidly as it has done in the US. And clearly, we want to carry on monitoring it. That's why we do a survey every year. But what we're seeing is that, for example, in the UK, about 15% of 11 to 18-year-olds, and that includes 18-year-olds who are adults that can legally vape, and that's actually down from the last year when it was 16%. Mm. Now, that's not to say that vaping isn't something that young people experiment with. They do. But we're not seeing large numbers of them going on to become regular vapers.
What about flavors of e-cigarettes? Because I think there's a sense here in the United States that, you know, flavors like strawberries and cream or bubblegum are kind of like a direct line to young smokers or would-be vapers. Do you encounter any of that?
I don't quite understand why this is such an obsession about flavors being the way in. It may be in the U.S., but we're not really seeing it here.
Here in the U.S., health officials veer away from promoting e-cigarettes as a healthier substitute for regular conventional cigarettes. I'm just wondering, how does the U.K. see that?
Well, both at population level, surveys of adults and adult smokers' quitting behavior shows that e-cigarettes are the most popular and the most effective quitting aid being used currently.
Deborah, how does regulation play into this? I'm wondering, you know, how does that contain the problem in the UK? And are you worried about what Brexit could mean for all of this?
Not really, because actually we tend to have more stringent anti-smoking laws in the UK than they do in the rest of Europe. So this is not something where there's going to be a race to the bottom. I mean, I think it's quite interesting because the FDA has been trying to put regulation of e-cigarettes into effect for a number of years, and they set the bar so high, they haven't been able to implement it. The EU came up with a more pragmatic approach with some fairly simple standards about the level of nicotine that you can have and how big the refill tanks are, and that all devices have to be tamper evident so that if they've been opened, it's obvious.
Deborah Arnott directs the nonprofit ASH, that's Action on Smoking and Health, in the UK. Deborah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Did you watch the debate last night? No, not that debate. I'm talking about the debate up north in Canada. Canadian federal elections are coming up in October. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is trying to hold on to his job. Polls show the race is pretty tight. Last night, the main candidates for prime minister squared off over taxes, Indigenous rights, and the environment. Boilerplate campaign stuff, but the debate was most notable for what it was lacking. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The debate last night got mean, and not Canadian mean, like actually mean.
Is tax cuts for the wealthy?
Tough. Tell that to dozens of communities.
Now you don't listen to me. I listen to you, sir. Left out, sir, they don't.
But they reserved their real venom for incumbent Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Justin Trudeau is afraid of his record, and that's why
Justin Trudeau promised that the budget would be balanced. That the budget would balance itself.
We know the Conservatives
aren't
going to
do that. Mr. Trudeau certainly hasn't done it. He hasn't shown up for 4 years for people.
He broke the law. He is the only prime minister that has ever been convicted of breaking the law. And he lied about it.
And here's what Trudeau had to say. That's right, nothing, because he wasn't there. There was just an empty podium where he would have stood. Candidates Jagmeet Singh and Andrew Scheer had a skeptical interpretation of why Trudeau wasn't there.
Mr. Trudeau hasn't shown up for 4 years, and he's not showing up to this debate.
If I were him, I'd be afraid of showing up as well. It's too bad, but I think Canadians will read into that a prime minister who is afraid of his own record.
Will they, though? Canada has three official debates, and if Trudeau didn't show up for one of those, that would look bad. But this debate is an extra, and not that many Canadians tuned in. So Trudeau had to make a political calculation of whether or not to attend, says Toby Berkovitz, a political communications professor at Boston University.
A candidate has to figure, do I need this debate in order to do better in the polls? Or are there a lot of issues that could in fact be detrimental to my campaign? And the more that those are aired, the worse it's going to be for me in the campaign.
And there are some issues Trudeau would prefer not to dwell on, like the SNC-Lavalin scandal that involves bribery, corruption, and funneling tens of millions of dollars to the family of ex-Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Trudeau was accused of trying to shield SNC, the engineering firm at the center of the scandal, from prosecution. So instead of standing on a stage and being attacked about that yesterday, Trudeau was doing more feel-good kinds of things, like announcing help for first-time homebuyers.
Owning a house should be a realistic life goal.
When he was pressed by reporters about his debate no-show, Trudeau said there would be lots of other chances.
I look forward to the opportunity to debate against my fellow leaders in the three occasions that we'll be doing in this campaign.
So sooner or later, Trudeau will have to face his opponents. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
LOLLMAO. I might not like them, don't really use them, but they're part of the language now, so I guess we're stuck with them. Obviously, they're based on English, laugh out loud, laughing my tuchus off. So what do people use in other languages? Our pals at the BBC polled the language services on the fifth floor of Broadcasting House in London.
My name is Beatriz de la Pava and I work for BBC Mundo. In Spanish, when we laugh, we do it as ha 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 ha. But when you write it on WhatsApp, I found that a lot of friends that are English speakers wonder why she is saying ya 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 ya. Because yes, we write it J-A-J-A-J-A-J-A. But for us, it sounds ha 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 ha. Whereas for English speaking people, it sounds ya 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 ya, which is not.
You find the sun laughing at life.
My name is Bu Kyung Jung and I'm from BBC Korean Service. When I do texting to my friends, basically there are two different consonants that you can use when you express that you are actually enjoying something. The first one is kiok, and kiok sounds like kukuku or kikiki, which is written as k in English alphabet, and the other one is hiot, which is written as, I think, h. The more consonants you use means the funnier the thing is, and you're actually enjoying that.
Lose all your blues, laughing at life.
I am Chayot Yong Jiran Chai, and I work for the BBC Thai service. In Thailand, we have few interesting ways to respond to some funny messages. We use number 5, because number 5 for us is ha. So when you put number 5 together 3 times, it's become ha ha ha.
So when you need a laugh, give me a call.
And now, sincerely, LOL, or shall we say 555, the voices of some of my colleagues at the BBC World Service in London sharing how you text laughter in Spanish, Korean, and Thai. Here's a novel thought, a lot of other languages just write ha ha. One of the things I love about the Beatles is how we can interpret and argue about what their lyrics mean. What's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds really about? What does it mean that Paul is the walrus? And where are Strawberry Fields? That's a real place and not just the memorial in Central Park. The original Strawberry Fields the Beatles wrote about is in Liverpool, and John Lennon used to hang out there as a kid. Here's the BBC's Colin Patterson with some big news for Beatles fans.
It's estimated that every year more than 60,000 Beatles fans make the pilgrimage to Strawberry Field in Liverpool.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to...
We're in front of the gate. There's graffiti. Everybody's signing their name, wanting to be part of history.
From tomorrow, tourists will be able to say not only are they going to Strawberry Field, they will also be allowed inside.
Strawberry Fields forever.
We're standing in part of the garden.
Strawberry Field was a Salvation Army children's home which shut in 2005 and was demolished. Jerry Goldman is the curator of a new permanent exhibition on the site, which tells the tale of how John Lennon lived over the back wall with his Aunt Mimi, and his illicit visits to the home's garden inspired one of the Beatles' most famous songs.
He used to climb over, play in the trees, and in the words of the song, nobody else is in his tree.
No one, I think, is in my tree.
What he meant was, I don't feel that anybody else is like me. And he used to escape into the garden here to get peace of mind. His Aunt Mimi used to tell him, you can't go there, it's private. And he used to say, ah, that's nothing to get hung about.
Nothing to get hung about.
Jackie Spencer has been a Beatles guide in Liverpool for 24 years.
I think it's going to change the whole tour to add some longer time onto it. But the fact that people can go inside these gates for the first time, it will make it so much more special.
The Salvation Army still owns the land, and profits will go to their project helping young people back into work. One disappointment, though. At the opening, the brass band couldn't play Strawberry Fields Forever. Apparently, the arrangement is too complicated.
That was the BBC's Colin Patterson. The brass band shouldn't feel too bad. It's not an easy song. Even the Beatles had to retake their performance a couple of dozen times. All right, for all you fashionistas out there, the future looks bright, literally. At New York Fashion Week, bold colors were on display, including tie-dye pants and dresses with a 21st century sensibility. If you don't know much about Fashion Week, new clothes are just part of the glam. Music is also front and center on the catwalk, from Rihanna's designer lingerie show to the runway DJs who make their names during New York Fashion Week. Mokken straddles music and fashion. He's a designer and a musician. Mokken began blurring his two passions as a kid in Cameroon and is still doing it today in the U.S. Mokken, tell us where you are right now.
I am in Atlanta, Georgia right now. This is my home here.
Where in your house are you?
I'm inside my closet right now wearing the tan shoes that I just made last month, and I'm sporting it with my the lace pants, you know.
Nice. How many of the clothes in your closet there are actually garments that you've designed?
If I want to count, so say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, about 8 right now. Then with a couple of ties, you know, I like making like really androgynous, unexpected ties, you know.
Describe one of your ties.
Actually, one of my ties is what's in the album cover. It's like I use like ropes to wrap the knot. Then I kind of like wrap 3 silver buttons. It almost looked like a shirt sleeve, but the robe represents an African, the struggling aspect of Africa. Africans, they like to tie bundles. It's like tying a bundle, but it's very, I think it really makes a very contemporary statement, though.
It's really cool. I mean, you like experimenting with materials. Also on that cover, I've got to mention the suit you're wearing. It seems to be velvet, rich yellow gold. Is that, am I right?
Yes, you're right, Marco. You're very right.
Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful. So we'll get to some of your new music in a moment, but which came first for you, fashion or music?
Oh, great question. Fashion came first because, Marco, I grew up in Cameroon when I was growing up with my mama. As a teenager, mama had an old Singer machine, a manual Singer machine.
Yeah, Singer sound machines.
Yeah, and I can remember right from the age of 7, I'll go to the thrift store and get nice American, anything that looks classic to me. I come home as a little boy, I'll cut it and alter it. That's where my sewing started. And I'll go to church looking different. Wow. Everybody will be looking at me, say, how I like it. He always looked different. That's how it started, though. I couldn't help it.
So you made your first impact with your fashion going to church. People looked at you and said, hey, that's I've never seen that before.
Yes, it started sowing a creative seed in my mind growing up as a teenager.
So, Mokken, some musicians, they write songs and then sing them. I mean, that's what you do as well. But musically, I got to say, you've got attitude. You've got a style that feels as intentional as the way you might design a piece of clothing.
You are so on this drive, I'm an only Lord garden. Your love is coming. Your love. Your love is coming.
your sun is rising.
Am I reading too much into this crossover of fashion and music?
Oh, no, no. You actually, I wanted to even read in more because that is my concept of fusion fashion and music.
I also think of, you know, the famous sapeurs in Congo and, you know, who are all about kind of getting dressed up for a musical event. But you're kind of sapeur and musician all in one.
Yes. And to tell you the truth, I think I'm very, very happy why I haven't stepped on any main stage yet, because I'm already have like four different concepts to present my music to the world. Fashion meets music, you know, Raza. The name Raza comes from roots. You see, I even have the slogan, Raza Wear by Moken, the house of Moken.
So when do we get to see this show?
In the next 2 months. I already have three modules who are already lined up right now. By October, mid-November, I'll be presenting this with the album at once.
Moken, a true original in fashion and music. His new album is Missing Chapters. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. I'm out for a few days. Carol Hills will be in the host chair next week. You all have a terrific weekend.
America, Africa, yeah, America. Even if I go over in Africa.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.